Acatra Foundation presents the Acatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Acatra AI. Okay, let's unpack this. Today we're diving into a truly fascinating book that might just challenge everything you thought you knew about one of history's most iconic figures, Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi. You know him as Mahatma the Great Soul, the architect of India's independence, a global symbol of nonviolence.
Absolutely. That's the image most people hold.
But what if his story, and especially the very origins of his revolutionary ideas, are far more complex, unexpected, and even surprising than that simplified saintly image we often carry?
And what's truly illuminating here, I think, is that we aren't just looking at a standard, you know, chronological biography. Our guide for this deep dive is Catherine Tidrick's Gandhi, A Political and Spiritual Life from 2006.
Right.
Tidrick's work isn't about meticulously tracking every single day. It's more of an intellectual investigation, a kind of forensic examination into the architecture of Gandhi's mind.
How his ideas formed.
Exactly. Dissecting how his powerful, world-changing ideas actually came into being. Which leads us to a really crucial question. Where did the philosophical foundations for a global movement really originate?
That's precisely where Tidrick's book excels, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Mapping out this unexpected journey through various spiritual currents. She makes a really compelling argument that Gandhi, far from being just a simple product of orthodox Hinduism,
mm-hmm.
was actually a masterful synthesis. He was weaving together this incredible tapestry of influences.
Things you might not expect, like Western occultism, theosophy.
Yeah, and Tolstoyan Christianity, Jainism. He then artfully repackaged these, well, quite eclectic elements into a uniquely powerful doctrine.
Yeah.
So our mission today is to explore this compelling, often startling intellectual journey, to see Gandhi not as some preordained saint, but as this brilliant, relentless, and maybe sometimes troubling spiritual seeker.
Whose political achievements were fundamentally inseparable from his lifelong, deeply personal quest for self-realization.
Exactly. So if you're ready to peel back these layers, let's dive in. Let's begin with his formative years and what Tidrick reveals about the, well, truly surprising origins of his spiritual awakening. She really pushes back against that common narrative, doesn't she? Gandhi as the purely homegrown indigenous Hindu saint.
She does. And here's where it gets genuinely thought-provoking. You might expect his foundational spiritual journey to have begun in India, right? Rooted in traditional texts.
Sure, that seems logical.
But Tidrick points to London. London as his intellectual genesis.
London. While he was studying law.
Indeed. While a young, somewhat lonely, and academically adrift law student there in 1888, Gandhi encountered theosophists.
Okay, theosophists. Can you unpack that a bit? What did that mean at the time?
Right. So Western occultism back then was quite a broad term. It covered various esoteric spiritual and philosophical currents, often looking for universal truths outside traditional religious dogma. Theosophy, specifically, aimed to synthesize elements from ancient philosophies, particularly Eastern ones like Hinduism and Buddhism, with these Western esoteric traditions.
Interesting. So it was a kind of melting pot of ideas.
In a way, yes. And it was through these theosophists that Gandhi was first introduced to the Bhagavad Gita. Critically, not via an Indian guru, but in an English translation by Sir Edwin Arnold.
Wow. So his first encounter with a key Hindu text was through English and European mystics.
Pretty much. He then devoured works by prominent theosophical leaders like Madame Blavatsky and Annie Besant, and later the Christian pacifist writings of Leo Tolstoy. His The Kingdom of God is Within You had a profound impact.
So this wasn't just academic reading for him?
No, not at all. It meant Gandhi, the future leader of India, was first introduced to the philosophical depth of his own cultural heritage through this distinctly Western mystical lens, and that profoundly shaped how he would later present it, both to the world and, crucially, back to his own people.
So this shy, somewhat lost young man in London stumbles upon what become foundational texts for his entire worldview, many introduced through these, well, Western filters. That's a powerful lesson in how unexpected encounters can spark intellectual humility and creative integration.
Definitely.
After this period, he spent, 21 years in South Africa.
Mm.
How did that extended stay become this crucial laboratory for these ideas that were just starting to form?
South Africa truly became the crucible. His arrival in 1893, and especially that infamous Pieter Maritzburg train incident, you know the one.
Where he was thrown off the train.
Thrown off a first-class carriage because of his race. That irrevocably transformed his personal search for dignity into a public mission. It forced him to confront systemic injustice head on and decide, not just intellectually but existentially, how to respond.
That must have been deeply humiliating.
Absolutely. And Tidrick suggests that moments of profound personal humiliation like this often serve as these unexpected catalysts for collective liberation movements. It forces a really deep personal question. How do you convert an opponent who literally sees you as less than human?
So from that moment of raw humiliation and this emerging understanding of systemic injustice, he didn't just react with anger. He began to internally process and then externally forge what would become his signature weapon, right?
Yes, his philosophy of Satyagraha.
How did that experience transform into Satyagraha?
He developed Satyagraha, often translated as truth force. Now, Tidrick meticulously demonstrates how this was far from being a purely indigenous Indian concept.
Right, you mentioned the synthesis earlier.
Exactly, it was a unique, powerful synthesis, combining Jain ahimsa, non-harm, which he'd absorbed from his mother's influence, with Tolstoyan passive resistance, and that theosophical belief in the intrinsic power of the soul. It wasn't merely passive. It was an active, courageous force aimed at converting an opponent through moral persuasion and, crucially, willingly accepting suffering yourself rather than inflicting it.
A revolutionary approach to conflict.
Absolutely.
And Tidrick emphasizes this wasn't just about political strategy, was it? It was deeply intertwined with his own personal transformation.
Deeply.
What's particularly illuminating here is his public vow of brahmacharya, or celibacy, in 1906. How does Tidrick frame that?
She argues this was perhaps the most significant step in his personal transformation and also in the conscious construction of the Mahatma persona.
Right, the great soul.
Gandhi believed that by conquering his libido, achieving absolute control over his senses, he could accumulate immense spiritual power. Ojas, it's called in some traditions.
Ojas, tell me more.
In yogic traditions, ojas is considered this vital regenerative energy, a kind of spiritual essence you accumulate through rigorous discipline, which could then be channeled into his public work.
So it was a conscious redirection of energy.
That was the belief. It marked a definitive shift from being a householder with familial duties to becoming an ascetic in public life. In a very real sense, his politics were, by his design, powered by this intense personal asceticism and an unwavering quest for spiritual perfection.
So by the time he returned to India in 1915, he wasn't just a lawyer anymore. He was a seasoned organizer armed with a fully formed ideology and, importantly, this kind of quasi-messianic reputation already.
Yes, he was ready. Ready to take these spiritual experiments and apply them on a national scale.
And he did. He transformed the Indian National Congress, didn't he?
He did. From what was largely an elite debating society into a truly mass movement. But, and this is crucial on his own unique term.
Like the spinning wheel, the charkha.
Exactly. The charkha became much more than just a tool. It was a potent symbol of economic self-reliance, a protest against industrialization, and a daily spiritual discipline all rolled into one.
Simple but powerful.
And then you see moments like the iconic Salt March in 1930. If you connect this to the bigger picture, it was just a masterstroke of political theater and religious symbolism.
Making salt from seawater. Seems so small.
Deceptively small. A simple, almost absurd act of defiance against a colonial tax. Mm. But it was simultaneously framed as a sacred pilgrimage. It mobilized millions, captured global attention, and demonstrated the power of disciplined, nonviolent, collective action.
And yet, despite all these monumental successes and eventually achieving Indian independence in 1947, Tidrick paints his later years as a period of profound anguish, a sense of personal failure almost.
It's heartbreaking, really. His lifelong dream of Hindu-Muslim unity was tragically shattered by the devastating partition of India and the horrific communal violence that followed.
It worked for unity.
Gone up in flames. He felt his core message of ahimsa, of nonviolence, had been utterly rejected. It left him feeling profoundly alone, like a spent bullet, as he put it. His final desperate actions, walking barefoot through riot-torn villages, undertaking fasts to the brink of death, these weren't just political maneuvers. Tidrick presents them as intensely personal attempts to absorb the hatred and violence himself.
Taking it onto himself.
Yes. And this period ultimately led to his assassination by a Hindu nationalist who believed Gandhi had actually weakened the nation. It was a tragic, almost inevitable conclusion to a life spent confronting the deepest contradictions of politics and spirituality. A stark reminder of the immense personal cost.
This brings us right to the core of Gandhi's philosophy, as Tidrick meticulously lays it out. What were the interconnected principles that really drove him, defined his unique approach?
Well, his philosophy fundamentally revolved around satya, truth.
But for him, it wasn't just factual truth.
Okay.
It was the ultimate reality. He asserted truth is God as a literal metaphysical claim.
Truth is God.
Yes. And ahimsa, nonviolence, was for him the only legitimate means to achieve this truth. But again, not passive, an active, courageous, transformative force.
Right, the active component is key.
Absolutely. These two foundational principles then combine to form Satyagraha, holding fast to truth. That's the practical application of nonviolent resistance aimed at converting, not coercing, an opponent. It's a powerful internal and external commitment.
Satya Ahimsa Satyagraha. And tying all these principles together, arguably, was his practice of brahmacharya.
Yes, Tidrik argues that for Gandhi, brahmacharya, meaning celibacy and absolute self-control, was absolutely crucial.
We talked about the ojas, the spiritual energy.
Exactly. His belief was that by conserving and sublimating sexual energy, he could accumulate that immense spiritual power, the ojas, to channel directly into his public work.
So his politics were powered by asceticism.
By his own design, fundamentally, yes. Powered by his deeply personal asceticism and quest for inner mastery. And this connection Tidrik explores is profound. How deeply intertwine are private ethics and our public effectiveness? It's a big question.
So if we look at his ultimate motivation through Tidrik's lens,
yeah.
What does it reveal about the driving force behind the Mahatma? Was it just about freeing India?
Tidrik contends that his primary overarching motivation wasn't primarily political freedom for India. Rather, it was his own spiritual liberation, moksha, his ultimate self-realization.
Moksha. Can you explain that concept briefly?
In many Indian philosophies, moksha is the highest goal. It's release from the cycle of rebirth, achieving profound self-knowledge and unity with the ultimate reality. So while Indian independence, Swaraj, was a critical goal.
It was secondary.
In a sense. For Gandhi, true Swaraj meant self-rule. Not just political freedom from the British, but individual and collective mastery over one's own base instincts and desires.
So self-rule within as well as without.
Precisely. And this spiritual framing explains his relentless focus on seemingly mundane things, spinning cloth, strict dietary regimens, sanitation reforms. For him, these were all integral disciplines for building not just a nation, but moral character.
Which is fascinating.
It's...
The Tidrik's work, thankfully, doesn't shy away from the deeply controversial aspects of Gandhi's life either. It presents a man who was as flawed and human as he was revered.
It definitely does.
Let's delve into some of these challenges and controversies because they do humanize him and arguably make his story even more compelling, if uncomfortable.
Well, what's particularly challenging and often debated are his experiments with brahmacharya in his later years.
Right. You mentioned these briefly. Sleeping with young women.
Yes, including his grandniece. Sleeping naked beside them as a radical test of his own self-control and spiritual purity. These acts were deeply controversial even among his closest followers then, and they remain ethically questionable today.
How does Tidrik analyze these? It sounds difficult to understand.
It is. She analyzes them not as a sexual lapse or a moment of weakness, but as the extreme, almost obsessive culmination of his lifelong quest for perfect self-control. A radical attempt to demonstrate absolute detachment and spiritual mastery, even in the most tempting circumstances.
But the ethical questions remain.
Absolutely. It raises that important question for us. Where does spiritual rigor cross the line into a potential abuse of power or a disregard for the well-being or agency of others involved?
Beyond these personal spiritual experiments, he also faced profound criticism regarding his family life, particularly concerning his eldest son, Harilal.
Yes, the story of Harilal is particularly tragic and poignant. It represents a profound rebellion against his father's towering moral authority and his all-consuming public mission.
What happened there?
Gandhi, in his relentless pursuit of his spiritual ideals, denied Harilal a conventional Western education, wanting him to follow a different path. He prioritized his public duties and his vision for how his sons should live over, arguably, his responsibilities as a father in a more conventional sense.
And the result for Harilal?
His life became a downward spiral, marked by alcoholism, financial ruin, an intense personal struggle, it seems, to escape the shadow of his saintly father. His story represents a profound human cost of Gandhi's uncompromising pursuit of his ideals.
And cost of sainthood, perhaps.
Perhaps. The cost of an all-consuming public mission, certainly.
And what about failures on a larger, more national scale? Tidrik details these two with unflinching honesty.
She does. She highlights moments like the Cherry Char incident in 1922. Violence erupted during a protest.
Which went against his core principle.
Exactly. And it led Gandhi to unilaterally call off the entire nationwide non-cooperation movement. He believed his followers were not yet spiritually ready for true nonviolence.
How did he recover from that setback?
His recovery was intensely spiritual. He embarked on a lengthy fast as penance and refocused the movement on inner reform, on building character. But his greatest and most devastating failure, the one that truly broke his spirit, was the horrific partition of India in 1947.
Despite his lifelong commitment to Hindu-Muslim unity.
Yes. His response to this profound defeat was, again, deeply personal and physical. Plunging into the heart of the violence, walking barefoot through riot-torn villages, undertaking those fasts unto death.
Demonstrating his commitment even when everything seemed lost.
Unwavering commitment to ahimsa, even in the face of immense personal and political defeat. It was a final, desperate attempt to reclaim his lost ideals through his own suffering.
So after digging into all this complexity, what can you, the listener, truly take away from this critical, nuanced look at Gandhi's life through Tidrick's lens? It offers some powerful, sometimes uncomfortable lessons that really resonate today.
I think they do. The first is perhaps an emotional insight. The father of the nation was, in many ways, a tragic father to his own sons, especially Harilal.
That story really sticks with you.
It does. It isn't just a footnote. It's the profound human cost of a public sainthood, or at least of such an all-consuming mission. Gandhi's quest for spiritual perfection created an almost impossible standard for those closest to him, leading to that heartbreaking rift he never fully healed. It reveals the deep personal pain beneath the placid, saintly image.
That's a powerful reminder. Even the most revered figures are complex, deeply human individuals with their own struggles, their own sacrifices. What's the intellectual takeaway from this deep dive?
Well, our intellectual insight is that some of the most revolutionary ideas of the 20th century were born, maybe unexpectedly, not in a village ashram in India, but in a dusty London library.
Right, the theosophy connection.
Exactly. Gandhi didn't just emerge fully formed from the soil of India. Catherine Tidrick shows us his core principles, like satyagraha, were this radical cocktail of global ideas, a bit of American transcendentalism, a dose of Russian Christian anarchism from Tolstoy, and that heavy, often overlooked influence from theosophy.
He was a master synthesizer.
A master synthesizer who, in a fascinating twist, effectively reintroduced India's spiritual depth to itself, but through a distinctively Western, or at least globally influenced, lens.
And finally, a universal lesson. Something from his life that we can all apply, regardless of our path.
I think the universal insight from Gandhi's life is this. His most powerful weapon wasn't a protest or a march. It was his own body.
His fasts, his discipline.
When he fasted, he wasn't just starving himself for political effect. He was conducting what he explicitly called an experiment with truth in public. He genuinely believed that by purifying his own body and mind, he could help purify the soul of his nation.
That's a radical idea.
It is. This idea that the path to changing the world begins with the difficult, painful, deeply personal work of changing yourself. That's his most enduring challenge to us all.
So what does this all mean for us here and now? Gandhi's life, as illuminated by Tidrick, seems to demonstrate that authentic personal and societal transformation requires relentless experimentation, that moral authority has to be earned and re-earned daily through consistent action, and that individual and social change are profoundly, inextricably interconnected.
You can't really separate them.
His example challenges us to embrace imperfection as part of the journey, maybe see apparent failure as educational, and understand nonviolence not just as a moral stance, but as a profoundly practical, strategically powerful approach.
And Tidrick's work powerfully reminds us, I think, that in our age, an age of deep political polarization, rampant consumerism, pressing environmental crises, Gandhi's core messages are perhaps more relevant than ever.
His insistence on nonviolent conflict resolution.
His critique of industrial civilization. His unwavering belief that our political life cannot be divorced from our ethical and spiritual life.
I feel urgent.
They really do. He shows us that the most powerful force for change isn't wealth or weapons, ultimately, but the disciplined courage of the human conscience.
The story of Gandhi, particularly as told by Catherine Tidrick, it isn't a comfortable one, is it? It challenges us to look beyond the simple icons we might worship and to deeply question the complex origins of even the noblest ideas.
It's supposed to be challenging.
So the next time you hear that phrase, be the change you want to see in the world, maybe consider the lifelong, often painful, deeply complex struggle of the man who truly lived it.
Mm-hmm.
It raises an important question for you, the listener. In what ways are you perhaps allowing a gap between your stated values and your daily actions to undermine your integrity and effectiveness, both personally and in your wider impact.
And his example suggests that closing this gap, while undeniably difficult, is both possible and profoundly transformative. The world desperately needs individuals willing to embody the changes they wish to see, starting with that simple but revolutionary act of aligning our lives with our deepest convictions.
To learn more about this flawed but truly fascinating architect of the modern world, we highly recommend exploring Catherine Tydrick's Gandhi, A Political and Spiritual Life. Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akhatra Foundation.